Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the local government subcommittee to order, and we're going to depart from the published agenda a little bit to hear House File 756, Hunter Cantrell's bill first, and I'll make a motion to that we let's see, what is Amanda, where is this going next? Oh, it's just information only. Okay. Okay, great. Then we don't have to move it to go anywhere else. So, Representative Cantrell, take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to bring House File 756 before you today. This is an informational hearing. I'm looking forward to kind of bringing forward some of the information around the necessity for passing this piece of legislation eventually when it is heard in a committee in which it will be passed, or maybe not, who knows. In cities and townships across the state of Minnesota, the fire resources that are available need more resources. And this bill, by allowing towns or cities to engage in a fire protection district agreements, would allow for a greater kind of sharing of resources and help to support some of the areas in which there have been some difficulties in terms of recruitment, retention, and providing for fire resources, these essential services that are part of the lifeblood of our communities. So with that, I will turn the presentation over to my testifier, Fire Chief Kieswich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify on House File 756. I'm Wayne Kiewicz. I'm the Fire Chief for the City of Richfield and here today on behalf of the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition. We are an organization comprised of four statewide fire associations. We would like to thank Representative Cantrell for authoring this important legislation. We believe this bill will help the fire service across the state of Minnesota. House File 756 creates a framework to allow future collaboration within the fire service. Currently, there are over 770 fire departments in Minnesota with over 90% of the staff comprised of volunteers. Fire departments are experiencing a significant challenge with recruitment and retention of staff. At the same time, fire departments are experiencing record high and growing demand for service. These challenges are leading to an unsustainable path for the Minnesota Fire Service under its current model. This is an issue in both greater Minnesota and the metropolitan area. All of this while the complexity within the fire service continues to escalate. Whether it is training requirements or the types of emergencies we respond to, the demands of the Minnesota Fire Service continue to expand. Firefighters, both volunteer and career, must be prepared to respond to these emergencies. The Fire Protection District Bill enables the creation of districts between two or more local units of government who wish to consolidate their fire services. The Fire Protection District is overseen by a board of appointed elected officials. The regionalization of the fire service under a fire protection district allows the fire service to better utilize a scarce workforce. The fire protection district can also share specialized equipment and provide more opportunities for the staff assisting with recruitment and retention. The fire protection district solution is an efficient and effective way to provide an important public safety service in a more reliable and sustainable approach. The fire protection district solution is also more transparent as taxpayers will know exactly what they pay for fire services as it will be shown on their tax statement separately as compared to being one of many services covered by a city's general levy. Currently, there is one fire protection district established through special legislation in Minnesota, which is Cloquet. The Cloquet Fire District has been very successful since the establishment of their special legislation close to 10 years ago. There are 42 other states with fire protection district legislation. There are many states that effectively provide fire protection services using this district model. We understand this is an informational hearing today, and we ask your support in passing legislation authorizing fire protection districts this legislative session. Thank you for your time today, and we appreciate your support.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the members on this?
Makes sense.
Oh, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Questions for the testifier or overall the whole bill?
Both.
Both today?
I'm Oh, I'm sorry. There is another testifier. I apologize.
Yep. I have one more testifier, Madam Chair.
Okay. We'll take the next testifier. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I want to thank Representative Cantrell for introducing House File 756. This is an issue that has been raised in our policy development process at the League of Minnesota Cities. Actually, it initiated a couple of years ago as our cities have found or sought ways to increase their ability to provide services at a better cost. And actually, a big part of this issue is really attracting and retaining firefighters and making sure that we can provide adequate coverage. In some of the hearings in the Pension Commission, you may not be aware of these, but there have been discussions of the fact that it's more and more difficult for cities to attract paid-on-call firefighters because people don't live where they work and work where they live, and it has made it more difficult to make sure we have adequate fire protection services. Our policy committees discuss this concept, and we do endorse it from a city administrative point of view, and would encourage your support for this concept. The Cloquet Fire District that was previously referenced has been a very big success. I think Moose Lake has a variation on a fire protection district as well. And those have both proved very, very successful in making sure that adequate fire protection services are provided. The one thing that our policy committees did want to make sure that we stressed was that we feel it would be important to allow local elected officials to serve on the board of a fire protection district, and this bill does authorize that an elected official could serve. Given that this has taxing authority, we feel that having an elected official would make some sense in setting those levies for a fire protection district. So, Madam Chair, with that, I would encourage your support for the bill, and again, thank Representative Cantrell for introducing this.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this bill, Representative Cantrell, I'm just reading some of the House research. Mm-hmm. So it says it prohibits a member local government from levying for fire protection of the district. So in your bill, by setting up these fire districts, the cooperation of municipalities, does it then allow the cities to retract their levy for fire protection?
So Representative McDonald, there is a section in this bill that I think addresses Madam Chair, Representative McDonald. There's a section on the back line 4.6 to 4.9 that outlines withdrawal. Does that pertain to your question?
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, the question is, with this new district, if this becomes law, is it then a double taxation that both the municipality and then the fire district? They are both then taxing as well, is that correct, a taxing authority?
Representative Cantrell.
Representative Mason, Representative McDonald. Could I get a little help from research office, please?
Madam, Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, in the bill itself, House File 756 on page 3, under paragraph A where it describes the tax, on 318, it says a city or town that joins the district may not incur expenses or debt for fire protection services in the district and may not impose taxes for that purpose. The last sentence talks about it can impose other fees or charges as allowed under statute. So it would not levy, under this language as I read it, they would not be able to levy for expenses or debt for the fire protection services, but they could impose other fees or charges.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I am a big fan of the fire department. Of course, we all are. There's the Delano Fire Department. I'm their non-official photographer, so I've been photographing them for 30 years, and they're just right across the street from my photo studio. So heaven forbid there's a fire, they'll be right there. And the many good friends, and being a former mayor, of course, a supporter. So my concern is that certainly I recognize, we all recognize the volunteer fire departments and their difficulties in attaining new members, because it is very taxing. It's a very big time commitment. for the families and the firemen and firewomen. But my concern, I believe, would be that yet another authority with levy authority. So almost a double taxation within the district. I think that would be a grave concern. I think maybe there's some testifiers that would help me, you know, get over that concern of the double taxation. And then also the opportunity to go to incur debt. You know, so how much debt limit is there within the bill? Does it allow them to purchase new fire trucks in addition to the cities who also purchase fire trucks? So some of those concerns, if you could address those.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, Chief Kiewicz will help to address your question.
Madam Chair, Representative, to your point, I think you're concerned that the cities would be continuing to levy at the same level as the fire protection district is once it's established. Is that correct?
That is
Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, thank you. That would be a concern.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think it's a valid concern, but I think what we're talking about in this bill is that the cities would no longer be able to levy for debt or tax capacity for fire protection.
Representative McDonald.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So in the bill, it usurps the municipalities the authority to tax and go and have debt service for fire department and gives that control then to the new fire district. Is that correct?
Chief.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. The fire protection district, and that's why we feel it's so important to have elected officials on that board of the district. This is a model that works very well up in Cloquet, and it's a model that is predominant outside of Minnesota. You'll see it throughout the western states, the southern states, and a lot of the midwestern areas down in Kansas, Missouri. It works very well, and it addresses a lot of the needs that the fire service has. Recruitment and retention has been an incredible issue ongoing in the state and actually nationwide for my entire career in the fire service, which is 23 years. If you take a look at one in your packet, you'll see what it costs to train and equip a firefighter. It's approximately $27,000 for gear, training, all the equipment. And then you add in that the volunteer firefighters, the average retention turnover is every 5 years. So 20% of your fire department is turning over every year, and you're going to spend $27,000 to replace that 20% every year. And that's in the paid-on-call volunteer departments. We don't have that problem in the career departments. We tend to have people a longer-term career, 20-plus years typically.
Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, thank you. Yeah, in the bill I'm trying to find also, maybe Ms. Dyson could point it out in what line, just if there are levy limits and debt service limits within this new taxing authority.
Ms. Dyson?
Similar to cities.
Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, again in that same paragraph, the tax would not be included in the calculation of levies or any levy limits, but I think as you know at this time there are no levy limits. So it's in that same paragraph on page 3, lines 315 to 322, where it discusses the tax. With regard to there's the short-term debt in paragraph B for equipment, and then I think there is some authority for long-term or in subdivision 4 on page 4 it has the maybe it is only equipment, because that just says that the debt that's incurred is under chapter 475, which is the procedures for municipal bonding. But let's see. It has a limit in paragraph B on the certificates of indebtedness for the equipment. You know, it's 5 years, and then it has that cap on 3.27, where it says before issuing certificates in an amount exceeding 0.25% of the estimated market value of taxable property, they have to go through the publication and notice for a potential referendum. It's a reverse referendum process for amounts over that limit, and I think anything below that would they would be able to issue without a referendum. But it doesn't. I don't see a specific cap on the spending, but that would be up to the board then.
Sure. Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Then, in lieu of that, do you, the author, would you? Well, I'd like to offer an oral amendment, but this is only informational, so we can't.
Exactly.
It's too bad that it's not up for consideration, more than just informational. But on line 3.6, Representative Cantrell, a district board member may be. My first bill 8 years ago was changing the word from may to shall, and it opened up all kinds of Pandora's boxes at the time. But anyway, it was in healthcare. Maybe you would consider changing that to shall be elected officials, especially if they have taxing and levy authority. You want those folks to be elected, much like the city councils and thus of us sitting here. What's your thoughts on that?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, could you tell me again which line you were referring to?
Madam Chair?
Representative McDonald.
Representative Cantrell, line 3.6, the second sentence. A district board member, right now it says maybe. Representative Kosnick said, suggested must be. I said shall be.
Representative Cantrell.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, I'm amenable to that, and I would very much appreciate the opportunity to discuss with you in greater detail kind of the nuances of that as we move forward and as this bill advances through the legislative process. Absolutely.
Good. And then lastly, Madam Chair?
We're going to go to Ms. Dyson in a minute.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative McDonald, I just wanted to correct something I just said, because the on line 3.23 it does say that the certificates of indebtedness are subject to debt limits. I don't know what those debt limits are, but it does say subject to debt limits.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Yeah, I did.
Wanted to correct
thank
what
you,
I had said.
Ms. Dyson. I did highlight that because I saw that earlier. Since this is only informational, Madam Chair, and this will most likely go to the property tax committee that I also am on, but other members aren't, will it come back here so we can discuss it as well?
And that my intention was it, if members want that, we'll ask for it, but in the meantime, because it's sitting in taxes, I wanted us to have the chance to discuss it. But if you want us to bring it back, we can ask to have it in this committee.
Madam Chair, members, I think that would be good for this committee, don't you think, to have it come back here after going through, since it's here anyway.
Okay.
It would make logical sense to do that.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McDonald. Next, I have Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the chief, on that cloquet board, are there members of the fire department or the fire chief? Do they sit on that that board in cloquet?
Chief.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know the exact composition of the board in cloquet. I don't know if the chief actually sits on the board. I don't believe he does, but we can get you that answer.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just some food for thought, perhaps, Representative McDonald. I certainly do appreciate your thoughts around that amendment, making sure we have elected officials, people accountable to the voters. On the boards, I just wonder if there'd be some way we could work the language so that if a township or a city or whatever the case may be wanted somebody from the fire department to be on that board, that, you know, that there may be some allowances there. So just something to think about. Thank you.
Did you want to respond, either of the testifiers?
No, I don't think I need to, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Cantrell. Representative McDonald mentioned the word may or shall in discussion of the second sentence in line 3.6.
Mm-hmm.
Which word did you prefer, that the district board member must or shall be required?
To the testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Kosnick. As we cannot take action on any amendment on this bill right now, I'm happy to have the opportunity to sit down and talk about which one would be more appropriate for the purposes of this bill.
Representative Costner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there's distinct differences between the words must and shall in the legislature. Shall being, if I understand it correctly, maybe you could help me, more suggestive, must being more prescriptive, that if it's your intention, and what I thought I heard you say was that the district board member must be an elected official, is kind of where I prefer to give more local control. I was just trying to get clarification if that's what the author's intent is or not.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Koznick. As this bill progresses through a committee in which there can be action taken upon it, in the interim between today and when that time comes, I'm more than happy to explore which one would be more advantageous and more beneficial for the people of our communities and the people who would be affected by the formation of these districts should this bill become law.
Thank you. Representative Koznick.
Thank you. I appreciate the honest answer. It's kind of evasive a little bit on which direction the author's intent is, so I guess I would prefer that if we have an opportunity to review the author's amended bill, I would like to see that back in this committee. I'd appreciate it.
Okay. We will definitely ask to see the bill officially. Are there any other questions of members? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify at this time? Representative Koznick.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you. I did have another question on page 4, line 4.7. I forgot to ask earlier, but for a municipality to withdraw, could the author kind of give their intent on why it has to be in the month of January? And also in terms of... I'm thinking back more recently to the withdrawal and dissolution of the CTIB board. That became quite contentious and really drawn out. So I have a little bit of concern on this without I think we could be a little more put more guidance and guide rails in this subsection of how the board or somebody may withdraw from the board. So if you could talk to us a little bit, share what your intentions are with that part, and then also why only in the month of January. I'm sure there's a specific reason, but I'm not aware of it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Koznick. To my understanding, municipal budgets are usually commenced with the beginning of the calendar year. So for the sake of budgetary ease and also for the sake of being able to understand the long-term financial picture of a municipality, I think that January component is sensible, but I'm more than happy to discuss with you, Representative Koznick, if you have some other suggestion. And then, Madam Chair, Representative Koznick, there was one other question that you asked. What was that?
Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cantrell, just... I don't expect you to have specific language today, but I think it might be worth taking a look at more guide rails on how the funds and stuff invested in the special service district would be dissolved if a member wanted to withdraw from the special district. City of Lakeville puts in a significant amount of money and investment, and it's not working out. They're not happy with the response times or with the way that the district is going. How would a city get their investment back in an equitable way?
Representative Cantrell.
Madam Chair, Representative Koznick, I agree. I would like to work with you on putting in some more guardrails to make sure that any dissolution of these districts results in an equitable partition of finances.
Representative.
Madam Chair, thank you. I don't know which... where the language necessarily came from this bill. Usually we have some different organizations and stuff that help us draft that, and that's appropriate. And I don't know if whoever helped us draft this has opinion on that, but that's certainly a concern that I have and would like to see more meat in the subsection on that. And if anybody who would help draft it, if you're not prepared, may have some comments to share with the committee today, would be certainly be helpful.
Representative Cantrell.
Madam Chair, Representative Koznick, I believe I'll have to circle back with you
okay.
on that part.
Representative Koznick, you're done? Okay, Representative McDonald.
Representative Cottrell, please know that in the 8 years I've been here, there's always, there has been a gotcha moment, you know, one side wants to get the other, you know, gotcha, and this is not the case. But right now in my district, we already have a mutual aid agreement with other cities. So when there's a big fire in Delano, Waverly will come over and Watertown will come over, and if it's really big, we'll have Rockford and all the other mutual the cities that are contiguous. And so that's already in state statute, and the cities are allowed to do that. How come this, why is this needed? Maybe the firemen can answer that question. When we already have a program adopted within the state that allows mutual aid, I think that's the name of it, of fire departments coming together to join and for protection.
Who wants to answer that, Chief?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, mutual aid and automatic aid are critical to being able to fight a fire. The City of Richfield, the Career Fire Department, we have 8 people on duty 24/7. It takes 20 to 30 people to fight and effectively fight a single family home structure. We can't afford to have 20 to 30 people on duty in Richfield. What this does is it allows us to spread that cost over more area actually reduce and reduce costs overall and improve efficiencies. You don't need 8 chiefs, for example, when you have a fire protection district. You need one chief and probably some additional supervision. You don't need the redundancy in equipment that each fire department has. That gets spread out over a broader area. It works way more effectively. One of the big problems is we're seeing in the fire service is people that want to be firefighters, they love it, okay? Midlife career change for me, greatest thing I ever did in my life. But you'll find people that are on one department are also on another department, and they're also on another department. So, for example, in the Southwest Metro, well, if, for example, in Richfield, I have firefighters that are also on Bloomington as paid-on-call firefighters. I have firefighters that are on Edina as paid-on-call firefighters. I have a firefighter that was on St. Louis Park as a paid-on-call firefighter. Well, when we have the big one, are they going to Bloomington or are they coming to me? And it's the same thing throughout the whole Southwest Metro. Which department are they going to? So we're all counting on these people to be at our fire, but they're not necessarily going to be there because they're wearing several different hats. This would assist with that. It would give us efficiencies in recruiting and retention. It would give us standardization in the district, in the geographic area, to say if you want to become a firefighter, you're going to be a firefighter not just for Watertown or Delano. You're going to be a firefighter for this entire region. And from a firefighter standpoint, I think it gives them a little more opportunity. It gives them more opportunity to experience firefighting in different areas and over a broader area, which is, I mean, I wouldn't wish a fire on anyone, but that's what we do, and we love going to fires. And like I said, I would never wish it on anyone because it's such a tragic thing, but that's we're there to respond, not just fires, hazardous materials, EMS, emergency medical services. That's 72% of our business is EMS in Richfield. So I think from an efficiency standpoint, from a government efficiency standpoint, this is a much better solution than what we are currently utilizing.
Representative McDonald?
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Is the representative
Elfin? Yeah, I just thank you, Madam Chair. I did reiterate that. I was a former city council member in Bloomington and would go to the firefighters' open houses in Bloomington in October and, you know, meet the firefighters. And most of them had day jobs as full-time firemen in Richfield or Minneapolis or another city. So just the situation where you described where one person might be involved in one way or another with multiple fire departments, as it becomes harder and harder to recruit volunteer firemen for the cities that are reliant on them, it becomes more and more important to, as you point out, you know, coordinate, you know, the personnel among multiple cities.
Response?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative, thank you. Yeah, we work very closely with all of our neighboring departments. Effectively in the Southwest Metro, we operate as a single department when we go to a structure fire. When we have a fire in Richfield, we get Bloomington, we get the airport, we get Minneapolis, we get Edina. We go into bigger alarms, we get St. Louis Park. I was at a fire 2 weeks ago in St. Louis Park. I live in Edina. I'm usually the first chief if it's the middle of the night, and doesn't matter. The Edina chief comes, sits in the SUV with me, we run the fire. So we effectively operate as one big fire department right now. But like I said, from an efficiency standpoint, you spread that out over a broader area, you're going to be able to achieve some significant efficiencies. I mean, a fire engine right now is $500,000 purchase. Mm-hmm. And if you don't need as many reserve engines, that's some significant money to the taxpayers.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Okay. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to comment at this point? In that case, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming before us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you, Madam Chair.
We look forward to seeing you again. Okay. At this point, I would like to turn over the meeting to the Vice Chair.
Before we do that, we have a quorum now, and I can move the approval of the minutes from the meeting of February 6th.
Okay, thank you. Representative Elkins is moving the approval of the minutes of February 6th.
I'm moving.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is accepted. Thank you.
Madam, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McDonald.
Well, the Madam Chair is moving to her the testifying table. I'd like to thank whoever gave us these delicious caramels.
Those are from Representative Cantrell.
Oh, well, be sure to thank him for us. Yep. Mm-hmm. It's very polite of him.
And then, Madam Chair, would it make sense, do you think, to conduct this discussion pretty much the way we did last time and have Representative Fisher join you?
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Thank
and
you.
I think it would also, I've talked with Ms. Naumann from Metro Cities, and I think it would probably make sense for her to testify as well. Yeah.
Mr. Chair. You know, I think we have some testifiers that have driven through the snow here on the other bill. Is that something that you want to make sure we have time for, too?
I think we want to make sure we have time for that.
Okay.
Yes.
Point that out.
Okay. But we had on this matter, we had a pretty good discussion last time. I think we're close to a consensus.
Okay.
And I don't know, Ms. Rue, do you want to summarize what the differences are between these bills? Or Deb?
I'm sorry.
Yeah. But probably good to start out by recapping. We've got two basic bills before us and a couple of amendments. It would be good to start off with just a summary of where we are in terms of what are the differences between the two bills, the main ones. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. The two bills before you relating to the structure of the Metropolitan Council, House File 192 and House File 370. At the last meeting, for House File 192, the bill right now before you is Sections 1 and 2 only. Sections 3 and 4 were removed by an oral amendment adopted at the last meeting. And then to do a quick recap of some of the differences, both bills provide for staggered terms. The effective date for the staggering of the terms is different between the bills, and I'm trying to get both of them in front of me to make sure I get this right. There it is. Okay. For House File 192, the Section 1 staggering of terms takes effect January of 2022, and for House File 370, Representative Fisher's bill, it would be January 1st of 2021. And the other differences relate to the nominating committee, which is Section 2 of both bills. And there is some difference in how the notice is provided to the units of local government in the metropolitan area, and then also in the makeup of the nominating committee. The nominating committee in House File 192, Representative Mason's bill, consists of 13 members total, 7 by the governor, and then 3 by Metro Cities, and 3 by the Minnesota or Association of Minnesota Counties. In House File 370, the governor is appointing 6 members, with Metro Cities appointing 4 and the counties appointing 3. And then there are some additional provisions relating to the nominating committee seeking out individuals to apply for the position. So there's some differences in the language and the approach of the nominating committees. And then another difference in timing is that once the three finalists, both of them provide for three finalists to come out of the nominating committee process to be presented to the governor. There's a, after the governor makes an appointment, there is in House File 192, there's 14 days for the public to review that appointment, and then there is 21 days in House File 370. Another significant difference between them has to do with the final part of the, it's in House File 370 on page 3, the last line of paragraph E. It's lines 3.21 to the end of that paragraph where it requires the governor to provide in writing to the nominating committee a detailed explanation if the governor rejects all three of the finalists, and Representative Mason's bill does not have that requirement. So let's see, and I guess then the other, there's another difference in the effective date. House File 370 has the nominating committee process effective retroactively to the beginning of this year, and would therefore apply to the people who are in the process of nomination right now. Mm-hmm. And then Representative Mason's bill, House File 192, has the nominating process changes effective January of 2020. And those are the main differences between the bills.
And I would observe that Representative Mason has a an amendment to House File 192, her bill, that would basically align the composition of the nominating committee to the so that it's the same as in 370. So.
Exactly, and I'd like to move that amendment, and then the bill will be in the order I would like.
Okay, great. So do I have any discussion of that, any objections? If not, all of those in favor of incorporating the author's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think we had a fairly lengthy discussion at our last meeting, so I'm just going to move House File 192 to go back to it. As I understand it, it should go back to GovOps. Mm-hmm. So that will be my motion.
Okay. Do we want to well, you should discuss that at first.
I can also mm-hmm. move that Representative Fisher's bill be laid over.
Okay. You guys are both fine with that approach? Okay.
Yes, okay, Mr. Chair.
And then, Ms. Naumann, can you just introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Patricia Naumann. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities.
Okay. And Ms. Naumann, do you have does your organization have an opinion about this?
Mr. Chair and members, Metro Cities does support, just generally, and I know we've testified to this at the previous meeting and in many previous meetings, that Metro Cities does support modifications to the governance structure of the Metropolitan Council to, in essence, provide more transparency and accountability in the selection process for members being appointed to the council, and we do support the opportunity for local officials to provide to have additional input on a nominating committee. So we do support an expanded nominating committee of 13 members with a majority of local officials on that nominating committee, and of those local officials, a majority being city officials due to the nexus of the work with the council and city governments.
Yeah. And a question probably for you. The bill, House File 370, would make be retroactive, so it would be effective also for the current process that they were in the middle of. But my impression, and wondering if you would agree with it, is that the governor's the process that is a practical matter the governor has adopted is actually fully compliant with the requirements of either bill.
Mr. Chair and members, the current nominating committee that just finished its work has 12 members, and with 5 ex officio members due to the constraints of the statute with 7 members. There are a majority of local officials on that committee, which we do support, and the governor has also provided for a is making the nominees public, which we do support.
Any further discussion? I know, Representative Kosnick, you have an amendment as well. What are the changes that would be introduced by your amendment?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think we have to move the amendment first.
What's your pleasure, Madam Chair? Should we?
Well, I'm thinking he would have to move that, but I'm going to ask to have my bill go through as is. So I would be asked to say no to the amendment.
You're recommending a vote against the amendment, but
yes,
we should introduce it.
But
yeah, you'd have to move the bill.
Move the bill, yeah.
Mr. Chair, I would move the DE1 amendment to House File 192.
Okay, and discussion?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. You know, as we had a pretty good discussion the last committee meeting when we talked about these, I recognized that there was some consensus on a variety of the different provisions between the two bills previously before us. And so what we recognized in the consensus in the committee, we kind of introduced the portions of the provisions that I thought were most agreeable to the committee to kind of have better consensus moving forward. And so the amendment, the only thing that's a little bit different is the appointment of the nominating committee is a little different from either of the bills, giving a little bit more input from the counties and the cities. Mm-hmm. And so what the structure of that, the governor would appoint 5 people to the nominating committee instead of 6 or 7 in the respective representatives' bills. The association, the county associations and the metro city would each have 4 appointments equally, which was a little bit of point of contentious between the Representative Mason's and Representative Fisher's bill. Same amount of people on the nominating committee, but I think it just reflects a little bit more input from our local communities, which I think is something that we've kind of struggled with a little bit and bigger issues in terms of having elected officials actually on the board, but this shows a little bit more local input. That's the main difference in terms of the ability for the finalists. We stuck with the 14 days provision that Representative Mason had, and I also appreciated Representative Fisher's kind of holding transparency and accountability to the governor of his rejection of any of the nominations made, and so request a letter from the governor is included in this. And then finally, the effective date, pushing it out rather than affecting the current nomination process that's underway right now. Again, agreeing with Representative Mason, Chair Mason, to the 2020 start date.
Okay. Further discussion, questions, comments? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would echo Representative Kosnick's comments and just support the amendment. You know, we took the best of both worlds. Both of your bills were good. So for some reform in the Met Council, of course, we don't think it goes far enough, but we think it's a good start. Mm-hmm. So because you two great minds thought together alike, we thought we'd combine them to one amendment. We certainly don't blame you for not taking them, Representative Mason, but we think it would be in the best interest for both of you as we put these together going forward and adopt this amendment.
Chair Mason, would you like to respond?
Thank you. I do want to make a couple of comments. One is I am more comfortable with the cities having a greater say because I think that's where most of the decisions are made on planning and development. So that would be one thing. I mean, I guess I might be open to changing it if you give the extra one to the cities rather than evening out the counties and the cities. The other one, the validity of having the governor respond, I believe, is difficult to get the answer that I think we would like to have. I just think there's an easy way of getting around that. So that's why I didn't include it in my bill.
Representative Cotton.
Mr. Chair and Chair Mason, I appreciate that, you know, that's kind of what I tried to do is have the cities have more input. If I understood your comments correctly, and you can clarify, is you wanted the cities to have an extra vote even above the counties, not necessarily, you know, my provision has, you had three people representing the cities. I'm giving four.
Okay, I have, on my bill with the amendment today, it's four for the cities, three for the counties.
That's right. I forgot about the amendment.
So if you wanted to change that, you could maybe make it
that would make that
five and five. But
with the chair's bill as amended, elected officials would have a majority of the nominating committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at my notes. I forgot about the amendment. So you know, I would be happy to make an amendment to my amendment to Representative Mason's. Allotment of the nominating committee. Okay. And Mr. Chair, Chair Mason, certainly I preferred to, rather than to introduce my own bill, it's just amend yours and have let you have control of the bill, and I respect that of you. So hopefully that if we change the allotments, you would consider this a friendly amendment.
Okay, so what I'm hearing, it would be five for the governor, five for the cities, three for the counties. Is that right? Is that your amendment or suggestion?
Mr. Chair, Chair Mason, I would be agreeable to that, yes.
Okay, I would move that change to my...
With that amendment, then,
what line is that?
Any further discussion? We can vote on Representative Cosman. I'm sorry, was there a question or?
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe Ms. Dyson can give us just the line of the bill and we can all use our pencils to type that in.
Okay.
Can you clarify the amendment to the amendment?
Yes.
Great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the oral amendment to the DE1 amendment on page 2, line 25, or I'm sorry, line 26, delete the first four and insert five, delete the second four and insert three. And Mr. Chair, I'll write that up for the committee legislative assistant.
Okay. Representative Kosnick?
I would move the amendment to the DE1 amendment.
Okay. Any further discussion?
As amended.
As amended, yes. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, we go back to the main motion.
Thank you. Members, we know that there's a lot of controversy associated with the Metro Council, and I'm hoping that at least if we take this step, it will do something to move more both accountability and trust in the work of the Council. So I ask for your approval.
Okay. Ms. Rudolph reminds me that we voted to the amendment to the amendment. Now we actually need to vote on the amendment itself. So I think we're in good shape there. So all in favor of the amendment as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Now we're at the main motion, and I think we're in good shape.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
I would like to see House File 192.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sorry.
I think for the record, you need to announce that the amendment was adopted.
Oh, thank you. Yes, the amendment was adopted. Yes.
And you can bang the gavel. It's always fun.
This is a good training exercise for me, obviously.
Okay, so we are now ready to move House File 192 to the Government Operations Committee.
Okay. Any further discussion?
As amended.
As amended, yes. No further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Good. Move. Ms. Freiberg, the bill's going back to you.
Okay. Thank you very, very much. Okay. And thank you for everybody's collaboration on
this. Thank you. This was good. Let's see. Chair, do you have the next item as well, don't you?
Oh, right.
Yes, we do. So House File 703.
House File 703, again, is for informational purposes at this time, but it is a significant issue that we think needs to be addressed. So if we could have the testifiers come down at this point, I'd appreciate it.
Yep. So testifiers, I see a number of them coming down. So if you would introduce yourselves for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sheila Kiskeaton. I am an Olmsted County Commissioner.
Good morning, Chair members. Luke Hellier, member of the Lakeville City Council.
If who wants to go first.
So, Mr. Chairman and members, I sat in similar rooms in the Capitol and heard this bill when I served in the legislature. It goes back to 1977. It was made really for political reasons, and it's been debated over and over and over again. So I'm hoping that this year the legislature will do the prudent thing and recognize that local units of government have duly elected officials who have to make decisions about how to balance their budget, how to attract the best candidates to work for the management of their operations, and not have the kind of unintended consequences that the salary cap creates at the local level. So let me just say that you have a letter from the City of Rochester. The City of Rochester this past year applied through your waiver process. So we've got here's some of the consequences. The consequences are when we go to recruit, when we have a department head opening, it is very difficult to recruit people from other jurisdictions, other states, because of our salary cap. And yet we have the third largest city in the state in Rochester. Olmsted County is the eighth largest county. And we're a fairly sophisticated county with a big range of services. So both the city and the county were in the midst of trying to recruit this past year, and the salary cap became a barrier. We also find that we have internal recruitment. So Olmsted County lost some very, very capable department heads to Hennepin County, because Hennepin County's doesn't have the same restrictions that we have on salary caps. So we applied, used the duly process. We applied for, I believe, five positions for the waiver process. Rochester applied for 13. Rochester got two. We got none. We're equivalent kind of positions. So the criteria that was used, and I don't want to go into the criticize the MMB, but the criteria that I used doesn't really make sense to us, because if it's based a regression analysis based on budget size and population, how is it that the county that provides a very broad set of services doesn't qualify, even though we're with the city of Rochester with a narrow band of services does qualify? And even then, you will see the letter from the HR director of the city of Rochester raising really serious questions about the consequences of this. Mm-hmm. The salary cap was put in place for political reasons. The salary cap says to local units of government that you do not trust the locally duly elected officials to be responsible stewards and accountable to their taxpayers. You now have an unintended consequence of prohibiting us and inhibiting us from attracting the best talent and from having to create some unusual ways to try and retain very, very competent people who are managing our services well. So it's time, it's 32 years since it first passed. I'm hoping that this year the legislature will have the resolve, the courage, and the commitment to reflect the fact that it isn't working well, and it is creating unfair conditions even within our own state. We have a workforce shortage overall in the state of Minnesota. We want to attract the best talent we can to our state, and we're putting an artificial barrier in the way of local units of government.
Good morning, Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to share my support for House File 703. I was elected to the Lakeville City Council in 2016, and I have the privilege to actually serve on our Personnel Committee. And I wanted to share an example of what it's like to hire a city worker. Our Director of Public Works left for Rochester last year. And, yeah, you're welcome. And after several months of on our own looking for replacement, we had two candidates actually from outside of Minnesota that we hired. Unfortunately, neither were a good fit. We ended up having to hire a consultant at a cost of about $30,000 to go out and do a nationwide search. We ultimately ended up hiring someone from Chanhassen who started yesterday, so right in time for the snowstorm, he's here. But I share that story not because it's an issue about compensation, but really to share how difficult it can be to find the right candidate for a job. Not unlike the private sector, finding qualified candidates for positions can be frustrating and downright difficult. On top of that, it's a burden on our budget and the taxpayer. One of the ways to prevent having to spend significant taxpayer resources on finding qualified workers is to adequately compensate current employees and incentivize them to stay. In 2018, we underwent a compensation study to ensure our staff was compensated at a level within their peer group and found great success. Some employees received raises and others did not. Unfortunately, though, when it comes to our top staff, our hands are tied to ensure we are paying a competitive wage with above average benefits. I would much rather give a few $1,000 raise to our administrator than spend tens of thousands of dollars on a search firm to find a candidate from another region. Opponents of this will say lifting the ban could result in a bidding war among cities about who can pay the most. As far as I know, that has not happened with school superintendents who are currently exempt from the law. In theory, campaign compensation of municipal employees should set a level playing field between cities on recruiting and retention. However, this practice has become unworkable. Due to the current waiver process, Lakeville and cities like ours, not only do we have to compete with cities in other states, we compete against cities like Edina and Rochester, who already are allowed to pay for their top staff how they see fit. Currently, the waiver process follows the position and not the employee. So when, for instance, if Edina's administrator leaves or retires, they'll be allowed to recruit at a higher level than what we could and could potentially, you know, take some of our staff. So for those reasons, I urge your support and obviously would answer any questions. Thank you.
Members. I'll just comment myself as a former Bloomington City Council member. It got difficult, not just for city managers or city administrators, but when you're getting into positions like public works directors where you're competing for, you know, mostly engineers in the private sector or chief information officers at, you know, medium and large size cities, it's a problem. Yes, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm not sure I want to support this bill because we have a great city administrator. Matter of fact, it was my best vote in my political career that I made in 2000. Let's see, it was 2000.
That's so, because he's a Johnny, but yeah.
Okay, yeah, you know our city minister, Phil Kern. Wonderful friend and seriously the best vote I've made in my political career to have. He is our city administrator, so I don't want him going anywhere else. If this bill does that, then I'll support against it. But in all seriousness, this is an important bill. How come it's only informational? We should vote on this?
Right now, we do not have a Senate author, so I just wanted to make sure that this committee is aware of what's happening, and we will. Once we get another author from the Senate, we'll bring it forward for a vote. And I'd also like to mention that, you know, if you remember last year, we had to do an exemption for the Metropolitan Airport so they could hire a director. And I'm currently sitting on GovOps and State Government Finance. We have some serious compensation issues at the state level as well that we need to address. So what is being brought forward is not just a local government issue. It's also a state issue that we need to do some serious work on.
Representative, can I follow up on that, Mr. Chair? Madam Chair, you have a great bill. Let's not worry about that other body. We're the house, baby.
Okay.
Well, let me suggest Senators Nelson and Senator.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
We should go through the chair for one.
Yeah.
With all due respect. But then also, I'll hold off my questions until after. I think we have a few other testifiers.
They've moved a few more testifiers. Okay. I see people waiting in the wings. So
thank you so much. So nice to see you.
Do we have a list or? Okay. Thank you. Next on the list is Gary Carlson from the League of Minnesota Cities. And Keith Carlson from the Minnesota Inter-County Association as well. So, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I want to testify in strong support of House File 703, and I would like to also indicate the support of the Metro Cities Organization and the Municipal Legislative Commission that also submitted a letter. This is an important issue that has actually become even more acute in the last couple of years. But we are the only state that we can find in the country that has any sort of a cap dictated by the state legislature that would apply to local units of government. So keep that in mind. This law was, as it currently exists, was originally enacted in 1983. It was modified in 2005 when we brought forward a bill with the counties to try to repeal it. We made some changes to the law that kind of, I guess, stopped some of the issues immediately, but now we're back, and I'll explain that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
We're really asking for you to allow local control, to allow us to make the best decisions necessary to hire the best people for the positions that we are needing to fill. The salary cap just isn't based upon economic reality when it comes to hiring and recruiting staff. Very briefly, the local government salary cap actually started as a cap tied to the Commissioner of Finance's salary. I think Ms. Dyson indicated that in the memo that she has included for the committee. In 1983, the cap was revised or reenacted, I should say, and it was tied to 95% of the governor's salary. And frankly, over many years, the governor's salary was never adjusted. And so we had many, many people that were actually tied to 95% of the governor's salary for many years while that salary was never adjusted. Coincidentally, in 1983, we actually created the Compensation Council in that same piece of legislation. The Compensation Council is charged with reviewing the constitutional officer salaries, judges' salaries, and in fact, they in 1997 recommended to you that we repeal the local government salary cap. That obviously was never followed through, but that was a recommendation. I'm sorry, in 2007 when they made that recommendation. Right now, the salary cap does have an inflation adjustment, and it's set at 110% of the governor's salary, and that ties back to the when the law was enacted in 2005 or was changed in 2005. And as you have in the handout materials, right now that cap is set at $175,621. Now, the issue that we've seen here is that in the last 2 years, we've seen many, many more waiver requests coming from local units of government, culminating this year with, as you have in your memo, 41 waiver requests from local units of government across the state. You've heard about the Rochester and Olmsted County examples, but to our knowledge, that's the most waiver requests, and we believe it's because the cap just is not keeping up with the current demands in the marketplace. So we provided you with written testimony from the HR director in the city of Rochester. I apologize, she had trouble getting here today, but she did submit the testimony. And just very briefly, to summarize a couple of the things that she mentions in her memo, they have had tremendous retirement turnover in the city of Rochester. And as they've gone back to the market, they found out that they frankly were paying people that were, you know, far off of what the market was for the positions that they're having to fill. They basically went with a consultant to analyze what they were paying people to find out what the market was, and they found that the salary cap was very much limiting many of their top positions in the city. In fact, one candidate that they tried to recruit was issued a counteroffer from a city in Iowa, and from a much smaller city, and the individual decided to stay in Iowa because not only were they working for a smaller city, but they didn't have the capriciousness of having this cap that applies to their future salary increases. So they actually lost a person that they had offered a job to simply because that cap created uncertainty for the future. Rochester has also been able to fill their positions with good candidates, but they do worry about retention. When that cap comes into play, if the Department of Management and Budget does not see fit to authorize a waiver, they basically cannot exceed the salary cap as set in state statute, and they do worry about retention of some of the good people they've hired. So I'm going to cut my comments short, but I would just like to urge you to strongly consider this bill. And I know there are ramifications far beyond local governments, as Representative Mason has indicated, but we really think it's time you consider really the fact that this law even exists and allow us and allow our city councils to make the decisions they need to make to attract and retain good qualified candidates. So, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Mr. Carlson. We'll stay for questions.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 14 of the larger counties in the state of Minnesota, not including Hennepin and Ramsey, but Hennepin and Ramsey do participate in our Human Resources Committee. And all of the participants in our Human Resources Committee agree that the salary cap is creating significant issues for them in terms of attraction and retention of top management. I've included a document that is titled at the front, Local Government Compensation Limits by Year, that basically outlines what is the current limits by year since the law was changed back in 2005 when it was disconnected from the governor's compensation and provided for an inflation adjustment. And I've included the history of the waiver request. We've certainly been grateful that the Department of Management and Budget under the Dayton administration has been more accommodating in some of these requests. But as has been outlined for you, we still have an absurd result where the city of Rochester gets a waiver request and the county that contains that has a budget that is more than 2.5 times greater than the city, is not granted a request for waivers for its staff. I've also included in the document how we compare based on surveys that's done by the professional organization for county managers and city managers and administrators. Just simply going across the border to Iowa, you find that for cities of 25,000, 50,000, that the mean compensation for those positions are above our current cap. Just for a cities as small as 25,000, the mean compensation for city managers in Iowa is $178,000. Greater than our cap, you go up to the larger. The same issue exists with regards to how we compare to the nonprofit sector. Sectors that obviously are also more answerable to the public, consistent with local governments. If you look at the latter pages, you'll see, for example, on the second to the last page, Opportunity Partners, that has revenues of about $34 million annually. Their CEO has compensation of $228,000. The counties that I represent have budgets that generally are in excess of $100 million annually, but yet they're restrained to compensation. The final issue that I want to make with you is this not only affects the top city or county managers or administrators, it also affects the staff underneath them due to what's called compression and the effects of the state's pay equity. Basically, to maintain the integrity of our compensation schedule, obviously somebody below the top manager can't make more than he or she, and has a consequence, even though the market would suggest that our top department or assistant or deputy managers should be making more, they can't because of this issue. That finally creates an issue for pay equity. In many of these positions, we have female occupants of those positions. Because the studies that we do that compares the compensation to the market shows that they should be paid more, we're found in non-compliance with pay equity because of the effects of the compensation. So we're caught between a rock and a hard place, and I certainly urge you to consider this bill to repeal the sense and put the accountability for salaries where it should reside with the city council and county boards.
Thank you. Representative Hurtado, do you have a question for one of these two testifiers, or should we have one additional person who wants to testify? Should we proceed? Yeah. Sir, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug Carnival, McGranchay Carnival Law Firm, representing the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. I hadn't planned to testify. Kent Sulem had planned to testify this morning, but unfortunately has weather issues like many other people today.
Mm-hmm.
The municipal utilities in Minnesota, there are 126 of them spread throughout the state of Minnesota, and these are very unique operations. They provide electrical power to their constituents within those particular cities, and a number of you, I'm sure, represent districts that have municipal utilities. They have a set of unique problems because the people who run those municipal utilities are essentially experts in energy management and production. They compete with the people who work for the investor-owned utilities for leadership or the co-ops, none of whom have the same kind of salary restraints, and we find ourselves losing executives or not getting executives to come work for our municipal utilities, especially the larger ones in Rochester or Moorhead or some of the other big cities like Austin, because they're competing in a marketplace that's that provides higher salaries to these professionals. These folks are unique specialists and run operations that are essentially enterprise operations in the city. They run off the costs that are shared with the municipal utility customers, mm-hmm. and as a result have an enterprise fund, so they pay their salaries themselves. But we have the same problem that the rest of the municipal organizations here in Minnesota have of recruiting and retaining the best talent to run these unique operations. So we wholeheartedly support this effort as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hertas, did you still have a question?
Mr. Chair, no. The question's been answered.
Okay, great. Any other questions or comments? Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Carnival or Mr. Carlson. Do you believe that perhaps, just thinking of some things, the effects of the bill, that it would force or cause the perhaps a good qualified employee to maybe skip around to the city that could pay them the most?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's a competitive marketplace right now. Many city managers do have relatively short tenures because they are advancing through their profession to larger entities that do pay better. But, you know, this, you could analogize this to what happens in the school districts right now. They're approximately based on records back dating back to the spring of 2017, 32 districts that pay compensations to their superintendents in excess of this $175,000 cap. Is there this footloose sort of degree? I don't think that's significant in there, and I don't think it will be any more significant within the counties or cities.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, in terms of the municipal utilities, it's more competition from the private sector and the co-ops than within our cities.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Carlson or Mr. Hellyer want to respond to that question as well?
Mr. Chair, as he comes down, if I may just make a quick comment. I see that this was enacted in 1977, and then legislation in 1980 repealed it, and then in 1983 they enacted a very similar cap. So personally, I'm going to have to go back and see if my father voted for this. and I'll judge my vote based upon his...
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, yes, there is competition among cities, in particular unfair competition and related to the fact that, if, as I mentioned before, if a city has a waiver, it stays with the position and not the person. And so cities, especially in the metro area, have a competitive advantage over cities like Lakeville who do not have the waiver when recruiting and moving people through position.
Any other questions or comments? We're not voting on this. Chair, do you want to have any closing remarks?
Two. First of all, I do want to thank everyone that made it here this morning. I know the weather has been very, very challenging. So thank you so very much for coming. Again, today's meeting was strictly for informational hearing, but it is something that I think we really need to be working on, because the salary cap, obviously, is detrimental to providing the services that our local governments are in business to provide. So, again, thank you very much, and I think we can adjourn.
Yes, so we are adjourned.
Thank you.